Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Wild Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jan. And I am continuing with our last episode of the month for Earth Month with renowned author Lydia Millet. We all have stories about our childhood and how we grew up around nature or maybe without it. For example, I remember the empty lot next to my house where I connected with nature, was digging around in the yard, rescuing garter snakes out of the pool, listening and finding the frogs after a heavy rain. Those were the things that I remembered. We all have that autobiography, that memoir of our relationship with the natural world. Before we get started, just a reminder, there's some pretty exciting things happening. Number one, I'm heading back to Uganda. I'll be there starting May 11th and undertaking an exciting education project with a couple of high school classes in Uganda, as well as continuing the mountain gorilla research. If you want to support these projects, you can head over to my website, www.jennifervertelin.com, and click on donate. You can also check out the new organization I've founded, Wild Connection. It's 501c3. That means it's tax deductible. So all of your donations are tax deductible. You can head over to that website at www.wildconnection.org. We've already gotten some great support in terms of equipment and even some donations. So join the cause, sign up for the newsletter, and you'll get some updates about that project. One more ask. If you feel so inclined and you're enjoying these podcast episodes, give us a like, share it with your friends, help spread the word. Okay, now to today's guest. Welcome to Wild Connection, the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jennifer Vertelin. I'm a scientist and author that studies animal behavior. I'm passionate about animals and exploring the complexity of their lives, their intelligence, relationships, families, social connections, and emotions. I also love helping people reconnect with nature to live better lives. This podcast is about you, other animals, and how we're all connected in this wild and crazy thing called life. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Wild Connection, the podcast. I am so excited today to welcome writer and conservationist Lydia Millet to the show to talk about her new book, We Loved It All. Welcome to the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Well, I am just, there's so much that you've done in terms of writing and conservation work, and we're going to get to a lot of that. But one of the things I love to start the podcast episodes with folks is to get people oriented to who the guest is and their background. So would you be willing to share a little bit about your background and how you came to focus your efforts in conservation and in writing?
Yeah, so I grew up in a really bookish family in Toronto in Canada, and we read a lot, and we also had a lot of animals of the pet variety living with us in our house. And even though it was a really urban upbringing for the most part, though I spent all my summers on a farm in Georgia, so I had this kind of bifurcated existence. But even though it was urban, it was really animal centric, and we collectively loved animals and constantly read animal books. And, you know, like so many kids, my brother and sister and I were really surrounded by animals. So for a while, when I was a teenager, I kind of strayed away from the other animals and into the world of human personhood alone, I think. But then later I came back to the sort of wild kingdom, at least in my imagination. And I have sort of remained there ever since. Although, like you, I'm really, really interested in people's relationships with other kinds of beings. And I am endlessly fascinated by those other beings. I did do a master's degree in environmental work, but it wasn't, sadly, it wasn't conservation biology, which I sometimes regret. It was economics and policy. So economics and policy of natural resources. And after that, I went to work for a national environmental group in New York, and I was there for a couple of years. And then I sort of fell in love with this other group, which is based in Tucson, called the Center for Biological Diversity. And I went and worked for them for free for a while, which you could still sort of do back then. You could be an unpaid intern. And this was back in 1999. And really, I have more or less been at the center ever since. Eventually convinced them to pay me a salary. And now my title is deputy creative director, I guess, there. But really, I'm an editor and I'm a writer, and I try to reach out with pieces of my writing to a broader community, as you do.
Yeah, and you do such a wonderful job of doing that. Just so the audience might understand a little bit about the Center for Biological Diversity, kind of what is it and what does it do? And then we'll dive into your book, We Loved It All.
Sure. So the center has been around for a while now, over three decades, and we really work on protecting endangered species, particularly under the Endangered Species Act, although there are plenty of other laws that we also rely on. And we were initially really focused on the Southwest, started pretty much in the Gila National Forest, but then broadened our scope to be national and now international. We have staff in Mexico, for example, and really do, we have a whole international program now. So while still the bulk of our work is in the United States, I would say our climate change, which we have a really brilliant climate change program, and that has also a really global focus. And we have like an environmental justice program now. We have a population and sustainability program. So we've diversified over the years, because all these matters of justice and peace and conservation are linked to each other, of course. And sort of the task of protecting and saving biodiversity is so interlinked with struggling for justice for people and cultures. And, we're losing cultural and linguistic diversity even faster than we're losing biological diversity. And that's also happening, all too quickly, as you know well. So we do. So we have a lot of lawyers and scientists on staff, and also now a lot of folks who support their work, a big communication staff and fundraising people and everything you need to keep doing this work. And we do a lot of litigation, and we do a lot of scientific petition writing to get particular species protected and their habitat, what's called, as you know, critical habitat under the Endangered Species Act, so that we can try to protect large swaths of landscape and seascapes for those animals to live in.
Yeah,
that's basically what we do.
That's incredible. And I think I was a petitioner on one of those for prairie dogs many years ago. It didn't succeed, but I was on there. So it's really very exciting for me. And your passion for wildlife, for conservation, just really shines, not only in the work you're doing there, but also in your writing and in this latest book, We Loved It All. And one of the things that I enjoyed so much about this book was how you really, you integrated so much history in the book and sharing experiences that you've had with your children, your parents, even grandparents. And I was curious what motivated you to essentially be so vulnerable in sharing so much of yourself in this book and take that perspective. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, I really didn't set out in particular to write about my own family history exactly, but I found that in thinking about the ways in which we detach ourselves from the natural world, I also had to think about the ways that we separate ourselves from history and the knowledge of history and even the history of our own families. And so all that stuff turned out to be, I don't know, part of this process of writing and thinking about the way we live or don't live with animals in our lives, the way we love animals and also make war on them, even though we don't want to be doing that in so many ways. We are, you know, and so it just turned out that all these things were woven together, and I ended up playing a part in the book. When I started writing it, it was more like this kind of bestiary, and it was very much sort of a tapestry of natural history anecdotes. But the more I wrote that, the more I realized how much is already out there and already so rich and lovely and funny. And I decided that I had to sort of try to distill something of my own out of this and try to use those pages to do, you know, to do stuff that I hadn't precisely exactly encountered before, which is not to say that you can't find these animal stories elsewhere, but I wanted to sort of put them together in a way that had some narrative drive to it, you know, and some occasionally little pieces of humor, although also, of course, there's sadness in the book and there's worry, just the anxiety of being alive at this overwhelming moment for the natural world and for human culture.
No, for sure. And one of the things that struck me and has always struck me, and I try to do, you talked about early in the book about the power of stories. And one of the stories that you told that resonated with me was the guinea pig, and it brought back memories. So in reading this book, We Loved It All, I think people might find that their own memories of their childhood and their experiences with other animals emerges, you know, throughout the reading. And for me, it was the guinea pig. And I think you had two males and a female, and I had two guinea pigs, and then they became six. And that was a lesson for me of, wait, how did I go? I didn't know. I was nine, so I didn't understand anything about how you made more guinea pigs. They just appeared and one day. And so, but for yours, it was really poignant because it was this realization of this different feeling we have sometimes to different animals and saying, oh, well, it's just a guinea pig. And I'm wondering, what is your take on why you think stories connect us so deeply to each other and to other animals?
Well, I mean, it's just, stories are just how we organize our brains. And we are, I think, sort of built to understand the world in terms of story, which doesn't mean that it always has to be a linear story. It could be a recursive kind of circuitous story, but we do always need this kind of through line of selfhood and how the self encounters others, and really event or like plot is made out of encounters with others, right? That's like what plot is. But I have to say that I'm distracted right now because I'm remembering that my guinea pigs also proliferated in that way, which is that we first had this one guinea pig, Trudy, and then my mother one day like looked over at her cage and thought that she had two heads. Like, and it turned out that she was like giving birth to this one of those boy guinea pigs who we called Herky. But we hadn't even known she was pregnant. We didn't have another male guinea pig. And so she had, I guess, come that way from the pet store or adoption or wherever. I don't remember. It must have been a pet store, I guess, where I do not get animals anymore these days. But Anyway, yeah. So guinea pigs proliferating. It's just a thing.
It's true.
And I was just so grief stricken when Trudy died. And I really felt a tremendous amount of shame, not for her death, which probably wasn't my fault, but for the way she had lived. And I've always had this kind of, and I think a lot of us have this really conflicted relationship with animal captivity and zoos. And, there's a really good case to be made that all zoo animals should be emancipated. And there's also a case for the importance of bringing people close to animals. Probably we should do it differently, but we do need to do it somehow. And and I talk a little bit about the role of zoos in this, just briefly in this book. It's not my focus. There's a book I really like about zoos called A Different Nature by an Australian former zoo director who actually once was a director at the Arizona Sonora Desert Museum, which is right near my house. He's an Englishman who lives in Australia, but he wrote a really, he's really staunchly opposed to certainly to traditional zoos and the way they're not built for the well-being of animals. And yeah. His book was really informative on that stuff. So I'm no kind of expert on that stuff, but I recommend that book, A Different Nature. Anyway, that's a digression, but I think it's really fascinating to look at the various different like social structures we have for interacting with animals and the position we put them in when we have them in our homes. It's certainly complicated, but the fact that we had so many animals around us growing up, I think was important because my childhood was I never went hiking when I was a kid or anything like that, so it was really urban. I took the subway every day from when I was like 12 to 17, I was on the subway for 3 hours a day and stuff. So it wasn't exactly a green childhood. Although I don't know about you, like in the 70s, we spent, which was most of my childhood was in the 70s. We spent a ton of time outdoors, just as what they now call like free range kids, which is like it's a positive spin, or, just kids roaming around unsupervised. And so sure. We were in backyards a lot and, school, little fragments of woods near the local elementary school and stuff like that. But we weren't in some pristine old growth grove or anything like that ever, really.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting that you say that because when I was a kid, part of my childhood was in Italy, and we used to go hiking Varese. There's the mountains there, and we used to go and have picnics, in the fields. And then we moved to South Florida, and I would climb trees in the backyard. There was a small woody area adjacent to our house. Backyards was the new wild green area. And we didn't go hiking in the U.S. We never took trips to national parks when I was a kid. That just wasn't something that we did. We didn't have animals other than the guinea pigs. It was not welcomed. I think I had mice. I was a big fan of mice, but most of my animal encounters were the random garter snake in the pool, playing with tadpoles that would just spontaneously seem to appear in puddles, when there were heavy rains. But I being taken to zoos and I remember SeaWorld at the time. Now I would, of course, no longer go to those venues. And I also am not a fan of zoos. So it sounds like I need to have him on the podcast to talk about his book and talk about that issue. But all of the stories and the way that you wrote We Loved It All evokes all of that. And for me, it made me think about how our connection to nature and other animals for many of us, and maybe not for all of us, may evolve over time. And so when you think about now how you connect with other species and nature, what is the primary way that you feel that kinship when in your own life?
You know, I would say there really are. There are a variety of ways, because I am a sucker for the rabbit hole of the internet of animals and sort of going, because we can see so much that we couldn't see in the past, you know, in a digital way. But of course that, like, you know, like zoos, which the internet of animals sort of is like a form of the zoo, it also is a very dangerous place for animals. It's a charismatic place for us in our you know, spectatorship of animals. I always should say other animals, but I forget, because I think it's important that we remember that we're mammals and that we're animals. But and it's really weird to me that, like, I will actually hear educated people sort of deny this. Like, it's odd. So there's that whole world of, like, the animals who don't live around me. But also, I really fell in love with the part of the desert that I live in, which is the Sonoran Desert, which you also live in. I fell in love with it. I love it so much. And I live out in the desert west of Tucson, where we see so many animals just passing through our yard all the time. You know, I just saw a fox the other day, a kit fox. We have javelinas, which people outside the Southwest or Central America don't necessarily know, but they're collared peccaries that travel in these herds, sort of look like maybe wild boars. They're very humorous looking. They have these giant heads and these tiny feet, you know. We get bobcats and all kinds of, like, we get lots of mule deer and every possible desert bird you can think of. We have this marvel of species in the backyard. And since I first came to this desert, which is actually, the, as far as I know, the most sort of biodiverse desert around. So lots of species of all kinds and lots of life underground too, of course, that we don't see. But ever since I came here, I've just been enraptured by it. I love seeing those critters. We even have, you know, we have a ton of western diamondback rattlesnakes, and none of them have ever behaved aggressively toward us, despite their reputation. Lots of tarantulas in the right season, just crossing the yard. You know, I feel very fortunate to live amongst these other creatures, and still have, because I'm really not hard scrabble at all. I mean, I'm really not handy. I would perish instantly in any kind of, like, disaster scenario. So I like having my laptop, and I like having, frankly, air conditioning and solar power and all those conveniences. But I love so much being able to look out my window and see other things than us.
Well, and so right now I've been fortunate. I work in Bwindi Impenetrable Forest in Uganda, and it's been years since rains came in the US and I heard the singing of frogs. And so I find myself, you know, where I stay, I can be working on my laptop, which I'm also very glad that I have. And I'm very fortunate. I stay in a guest house that has pretty much constant power, clean water, definitely a privilege there. And yet I can be there and all of a sudden a red-tailed monkey just is there. And or birds, or the frogs that go boing 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 every time it rains, and I've never seen one of them, but I hear them, you know, like a cacophony of sounds, and it's very calming for me. And yes, I live in the desert Southwest, but I also realize that it has changed dramatically in terms of population density and growth and urbanization. And while you and I may go, I love seeing the peccaries cross my yard, or I love seeing the tarantula just to make its way, you know, moving. And I agree. You know, what people don't understand about rattlesnakes a lot of times is that they're camouflage predators. They don't really want to be discovered. And so they pretty much take the posture of like, no, I'm not here. Oh, you see me. Darn it. Okay. I've got to do something about it to get away. And so they're not aggressive. It's mostly accidental, or unless you've deliberately disturbed, which many people don't seem to. I always talk about other animals having personal space boundaries, you know, and it varies by species and by individual within a species. So what I think of sometimes when I think about the desert Southwest and some of these species that both you and I may feel thrilled that we get the opportunity to see them. And, you know, I've noticed, and it's not just in the desert Southwest, that some species are exalted while others are vilified. And I'm curious, because you talk so much about the importance of stories, you know, what role do you think stories play in defining how we feel about other species?
Well, I think they play, you know, a huge role. And the part of this particular book, We Loved It All, is devoted to talking about how we need to change the stories we tell, not only about other creatures, but about ourselves, you know, that we've had a fixation on making ourselves into heroes for a very long time. And it is the moment, I think, to remove us as the sun at the center of that system and understand ourselves more as a planet, along with all the other planets that revolve around that true sun that gives life. And I think that, you know, our stories have been, first of all, they've often been based in fear and for, you know, understandable reasons, sometimes historically, you know, of course there are conflicts in nature and there are conflicts between people and the rest of nature, and that's all part of it. But really, I think our task now is to reach out our arms and try to gather all these beasts into the ark with us, and to really understand that they are our life support. You know, they are not only our physical life support in so many ways in that web of life that we need to have clean air to breathe and water to drink and not be overheated. But they're also really part of who we are. You know, we co-evolved with them. We've never lived in a world without this vast number of different forms of life in it. And we don't want to. That would be a really impoverished kind of world for us to live in. And yet there is so much we can do right now with this love that we may or may not even know we feel toward the rest. But I believe most people do have it lying under there somewhere. And I think it actually is quite easy to call forth. And you see that sort of all over the place when people are allowed to really look deeply at the lives of animals, that sparkling charisma that animals and plants, by the way, I definitely give short shrift in my book, just because of the way it got sort of whittled down to the wonderful, wonderful plants and trees and that directly give us life and their marvelous variety, which is so fascinating. They're harder to write about than animals in certain ways because they don't move around and generate plot the way that we do, but they are so, so fascinating and beautiful. And like, what would it be like to not be surrounded by different sorts of trees? Even in the city, you can find trees to give you shade and coolness and comfort. And yeah, I think absolutely critical. Not just in an obvious, again, like physical way, but also just culturally. And we really define ourselves from the time we're born. And this sort of holds true across, you know, it's across many, many cultures, if not all, that we define ourselves and create language out of the other life forms that we see around us. And it's just so intrinsic to who we are.
Yeah.
And we need to sort of acknowledge the depth of that ancient relationship.
Well, and gosh, there's so much to unpack there, because this also ties to what you mentioned earlier about bestiaries, right? And how those sort of mythical stories and fables and things that integrate other animals sometimes, you know, reflect certain traits about those animals that and plants that are accurate, and other times are a tool or might reflect that conflict that you talk about. You know, I'm so focused on mountain gorillas right now, and I can't help always but think, you know, there's these two stories that people have. One is that they're gentle giants. And then the other story is King Kong. And the truth is in the middle. The truth is, you know, I have never bumped up against a wild, non-habituated mountain gorilla. I have been informed by those who have, typically the rangers and trackers that work with them, that you would curse the day you're born.
So what is it like when you encounter, what have they said? What is that story?
You curse the day you're born was the only way it was described. And you know,
because they're so fearsome. I mean, they're so powerful, right?
Absolutely. And I have been exposed and charged by a 450-pound silverback who stopped just 3 feet. And I had a nightmare the next night. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I said, I wonder, is it possible that this could be a little bit dangerous?
Right.
It doesn't stop me. And you know, you just can end up in a situation. And it never made me think poorly about mountain gorillas at all. It's just, but the truth is more complicated, you know, and you brought up this idea that humans have this insistence that we're special and that we're elevated above all other things. And if they don't behave in a way that, you know, meets our narrow criteria of what we decide is a good animal and what is a bad animal, you know, I even have a friend recently who said, I've got this goose. And it's hissing at my dog. What should I do? I said, keep your dog away from the goose.
Right.
Exactly. Very simple. The goose sees your dog as a predator. You will never teach the goose to not see your dog as a potential predator. You can teach your dog to walk on a leash, or you can put up a fence, or you can, you know, respect the personal boundary that this goose has for its own sense of safety and security, to try to understand it's not being a jerk goose. There's no, you know, I'm sure among geese, there's a goose that's a jerk. And, you know, but in general, you know, this idea that also, people like me get accused of anthropomorphizing other animals, and it's like the kiss of death, you know, for science. I zoomorphize people, not because we are animals, right? It's us and other animals. So we don't have the market on love, jealousy, frustration, deceit, selfishness, insecurity, anxiety, you know, confidence or lack thereof. I have, when you spend time with other animals outside of even just your own pets, if you have them, people can witness the dramas that other animals have in their lives. They've got social dramas, they've got friend dramas, you know, even work dramas, because they're out there trying to make a living too, right? And so
that's exactly right.
And so how do you think we can overcome this idea that we're so fundamentally special?
First of all, I think like that what you say about good and bad animals is really important. I think we also tell stories about good and bad people. And as we as we get older and more, and we learn more things and we have more experiences, we understand that it is very rare that you can truthfully say that a person is just good or just bad, right? It is a very, obviously reductive and largely false way of looking at the world. And really it is the same with animals. And I think we have, we have far to come in both those domains, you know, and sort of seeing people as bad or threatening or wholly good is clearly unsubtle and false. And art, you know, is there to help us with that. And it can also help us with the foolishness of our narrative about animals that that says that some are good and bad. And I think we really still do to some degree, at least in parts of our cultures, cling to those ideas. There's it's not only animals that are a danger to us, because of course most of us live quite far, are used to being apex creatures by now in our cities and stuff, and live far away from nature. And those who don't are often do perceive themselves often in direct conflict with animals. But there are also like whole categories of animals as nuisances or pests or whatever. And those categories are also problematic. And just like people, animals, yes, of course they can be dangerous when threatened. Or they can be a nuisance because, you know, they might need to bite you to get some blood for their baby mosquitoes, I guess, you know. those things are just aspects of their being, as those things are aspects of our being. And like, you know, this is all kind of obvious, but the truth is that we still are pretty wedded to heroes and villains in our stories. And it really falls to us now to try to be more complex and delicate in how we approach these kind of dualities, and maybe try to reduce their simplicity.
I think it's hard, maybe because just as humans, our brains are wired for categories. We like boxes to put things in. And I think just generally we struggle with the grayness of the reality of things. And I think other animals do too. You are a threat or not threat, or you're not a threat until you are a threat. and I would be hard pressed to find, you know, I could say with certain species, they escalate their warning in a, and that's the grayscale, right? It's okay. We were fine. We're a little not fine. Okay. We're approaching not fine. We're really not fine. Yeah. This is bad. And that could happen very quickly, is, you know, so that people could miss the cues. And so it's interesting, though, because I've always thought of other species, other animals as independent beings. Mm-hmm. And you talk about this a little bit in the book, We Loved It All, this movement towards awarding personhood. And that also ties to that anthropomorphism, because as someone who has studied personality in other species, I bumped up against this strange thing called behavioral syndromes by other scientists who rejected using the word personality for other animals because it had the word person in it. And yet here we are also like awarding on a limited basis personhood to orangutan, to I think an elephant, I think even some cetaceans, whales and dolphins. And I always thought, but what about the bobcat? Does the bobcat get personhood? Why not? Right. Where is this criteria for personhood? And I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit, even if it's just kind of your point of view or perspective on that movement.
Yeah. I mean, I really love the movements for legal personhood, not only for critters and plants, trees, theoretically, but also for ecosystems and, you know, rivers and I don't know, bays, coastlines. I think it's a great movement because our awarding of personhood has always been sort of arbitrary and capricious, especially in the US, where we allow corporations to be treated as persons under the law. So I think it's a really actually quite exciting movement that we the animal people should support. But I agree that it is sort of tricky, I think, just because we have the scale bias where we feel sort of absurd giving personhood to tiny creatures like an ant. You know, it is still hard. For example, at my work, we've recently, like in the past few years, instituted a style practice of referring to animals as who rather than which. And I love that, although I do, like, even talking to you, I've made mistakes, like javelinas, which, you know, it's just a natural thing that we're used to speaking of animals as objects, right?
Yeah.
But really they are whose. But even when you try to do that, you still feel kind of silly talking about like a brine shrimp, a single brine shrimp as a who, right? And that's sure. Because we just aren't able to fathom selfhood for beings we consider to be less complex or less neurologically endowed, or, you know, however you might want to put it. But really, it's a highly subjective distinction. I mean, I really love what people call anthropomorphism, and I like the zoomorphism that you talk about too. And it is a two-way street. What a childish, in a bad way, idea it is to believe ourselves unique in having affect. You know, it's just not, there's no scientific basis for such an assertion, such a claim. You know, it's just, and yeah, there's not really even an intuitive basis for it. You know, there's really no basis for it. We perceive that animals have desires, and we really have no proof that our own desires are not equally elemental, you know, and instinctive.
Yeah.
So and there's nothing wrong with those things either. You know, it's not wrong. I think there's something about, we need to be able to think of non-human actors as individuals. And I think we kind of do naturally in many cases, that's our natural impulse. We need to, but we all, and ourselves the same way with all these different shades of gray and forms of personality. And we also need to be able to think sort of, and it's, we're allowed to be afraid of a bear that's charging us or whatever. That's, and so that's an individual thing too. That's like a case where you're face to face with someone who threatens you, right? And of course you should feel fear, but also we need to be able to think, I think, differently of the collective and of the, you know, sort of macro social aspects of human and animal being. And we need to be able to say, well, what we should be afraid of there, you know, is something else entirely. It is actually the disappearance of that bestiary, the disappearance of that richness of existence. That is what we need to fear. And we need to act on a macro scale to protect it, no matter what our momentary individual fears might be of, say, a Mexican gray wolf or a grizzly bear, or, as you say, a silverback, not in Arizona, but in Uganda. You know, so we need to be able to sort of understand that it's okay to see people, animal people included, in a different way collectively than we see them when we encounter them personally. You know, yeah, we need to be able to reconcile those things and to really work to preserve the collectivity.
There's a lot to think about there. One of the things that jumped out at me was when you were saying how, you know, we say which or that, treating other animals as objects. We also have a tendency, it's very similar to every animal that you don't know the gender of or the sex of is a male. And so I've had to work hard to go, he or she. And when I just recently published a paper on prairie dogs, I wrote, and it was, you know, they wanted it changed, and I insisted that I kept she. When I was describing the behavior of a female prairie dog, I said, she did X, she did Y, then she did this. And they were like, it should be it. And I'm like, it's not an it, it's a she.
Right.
I know that it's a she, and I'm describing what she was doing.
You shouldn't even have to argue about that.
I know, but it's right. That's how pervasive it can it is to have this separation, you know, in place. And it doesn't affect the science in any way to say it is a she versus it is an it. She was a she, and that's it.
I would say it only improves the science because you're being more precise.
Exactly. And so where you said that, like shifting our perspective from our individual potential encounter with another species and how it might immediately impact us, you know, we do have a lot of human wildlife conflict in various contexts. But one of the things that I really enjoyed about We Loved It All is this juxtaposition you have and what you've also just been talking about between the love we seem to have for, you know, like the nature and the animals out there against this backdrop of not only the individual sort of conflict that people might have, but this backdrop of most people not noticing that other animals, wild animals, are suffering, vanishing. We build memorials to animals that have disappeared, but we continue behaving in ways that lead to more disappearance because individually, I want to grow strawberries in my yard in the desert, so I don't want javelina there. You know, why do you think we're so divorced from the consequences of our lives on other species?
I mean, it's partly because we've taught ourselves exactly what you say, which is that we're exceptional and we are elevated and we have this sort of primary right to exist and to use other animals for our own good. I mean, we just have this, you know, we have assigned, you know, what economists call this utility or use value to other critters and plants also. And it is a very rudimentary way of looking at that relationship. And we really have been encouraged. Our cultures under capitalism, for example, and chiefly, I think in many ways, have really been teaching us to see ourselves as chosen. And it's really a highly irrational form of egotism, narcissism, you know, this human exceptionalism that we practice. But it really is taught to us. It's taught to us, and it's sort of received wisdom or non-wisdom. And there's a sense of human entitlement, right? And I think we've handed that down through the generations, and it's something we need to cast off.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is, you know, in the book, you bring up all these complex topics, like from ecosystem services, you know, and this economic valuation of other animals and elements. And I think that what you were saying earlier about we really need to reconnect, you know, in the heart level to other species and plants and the environment, that doesn't happen through an economic lens. It happens from spending time in nature and observing and connecting with other species in a positive and healthy way for both. Do you think that today kids are missing that experience, right? That you and I grew up with of, you know, running around in the woods, running around outside, finding different critters, you know. Do you think they're missing that experience, and how do you think it will impact their commitment to protecting species and environments in the future?
I mean, I think there's a lot of scholarship out there that says, yes, they are missing it and it is bad for them. And, you know, we know that just sort of being in front of screens a lot is bad for developing brains. And I think in the same way, it's bad for, you know, what you call the heart, you know, the heart. And like my own son recently went on this wilderness program, and it just was so extraordinary to him. It just absolutely fascinated and captivated him, and, you know, changed his life. It changed his life for the better. And even though, like, he likes Minecraft, you know, and he can get really, really involved in that. He also loves animals, and he, you know, he looks at his fair share of cat videos, you know? And I do think that there's something really magical and valuable also in kids having access to footage of animals. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think there are pernicious facets of it. It is possible for things about that engagement to be darker. But in general, I think it is better than nothing, right? For kids to have exposure to even TikTok videos, as long as they're not, right, like, disgustingly exploitative and abusive, which they often are of those animals, and you can't know because there aren't good filters for that stuff or laws governing how that content is created and shared. I do think, though, that all kids, you know, should be able to be in nature sometimes. And I really do think it should be part of our civic life that is promoted on their behalf, and that they are taken to nature. All kids, you know, everywhere.
It's interesting, right? Because I think that there's a rise in you use endling and nostalgia, in which were new terms for me. I'm much more, you know, familiar with, like, eco anxiety and ecological grief. And I think that a lot of young people are experiencing, you know, increased eco anxiety. I'm just going to use that phrase, but more in the sense of this holistic sort of climate change and how it might impact them in the future. And, you know, I don't know if other animals know about changes in the climate and how it's impacting them from a reflective thinking point of view. You know, they might just be bumbling around like us, reacting to what's happening and just trying to find a way to survive. You know, do you think that, I mean, this is a big question, right? And then I know you're very busy, and I'll only press you with one more question after this. But, you know, do you experience any version of a sort of hopelessness or grief as you're watching the world change around us?
I mean, it's not exactly hopelessness, but definitely like a sense of desperation and urgency. And you can be just really blindsided by news, even just news of, like, a mother right whale being struck by another ship because they go too fast through whale habitat, you know, and killed. And just these individual stories, as well as, like, aggregate statistics, and can be heartbreaking at moments. But in general, I just feel this, like, really great sense of desperation for people to sort of rise up and take action to protect what we don't even know we love yet. And I think there is a risk. Kids are definitely aware of the climate threat in this country, and my kids among them. I mean, it's just a given to them, but also a lot of their friends, you know, who aren't exposed to people like me that often, that there is an ambient anxiety around that, I think, absolutely. But not so many of them are necessarily aware of the extinction threat and how critical that is also. And I think we do need to tell that story always along with the climate story.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and as someone who also reaches into the biological diversity toolbox, You reference and share so much about many different species. You don't rely just on our closest relatives to build that bridge. And I really enjoyed that and appreciated that. So you may not have an answer to this question, but do you have a favorite species?
Oh, yeah, I love so many. I kind of go in phases of kind of being in love with a certain kind of critter. You know, like I've definitely had elephant. Like elephant is one of, elephants have always been dear to me since I was a kid. And I've never seen one, by the way, outside a zoo where they are so miserable. Yeah. But I love them, but I kind of love everything. I've also had sea turtle phases and definitely just like marine mammals, but then also just like, I'll just be fixated on a local animal that like just gambles quail. I love.
They're funny.
So funny. They're so funny. Yes. I love them.
They make some bad decisions sometimes though, when
they really do. Yes. Yes. I mean, they are constantly like laying their eggs in places around my house, like where it does not end well. It does not end well.
I know.
But yeah, so I'm always like, I'm just like love most the animal I'm looking at that moment.
Yeah, that's great. So if you should come to Uganda, you come and we'll see elephants.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. And I, you know, I love all animals. I was in love with mountain gorillas. I can't believe I get to study them now. It's like kind of a miracle. But then I fell in love with prairie dogs, and I can spend an entire afternoon just watching a squirrel, you know, and I love coyotes and I love bobcats, you know, in the desert Southwest. When I've passed a bobcat that was laying down, it got up, then it was like, I'm a bobcat, and just laid back down, you know, and like, you are.
Yeah, we get them in my yard. We have like mothers with their babies, like just on the roof one season. Yeah. Bobcats are so beautiful. They really are. And they're kind of a perfect size of wild cat for us to engage with, because we don't actually need to be afraid of them, you know, and that's such a luxury with a wild feline in a way, you know.
Yeah, for sure. And what I would love people to understand is learn about the animals they go see. I struggle when I see people traveling to see other animals and they engage in behaviors that are actually harmful to that individual or that animal or are harassing because they want to get close. And I think that understanding that love that wants you to get close is great, and don't get close.
Right. No, exactly. You have to hold those in your mind at the same time.
Yeah. Wow. Lydia Millett, we loved it all. It was such an amazing book. I want everybody to go get it. And if people want to keep up with you, where can they find you and where can they get a copy of the book?
Well, they can buy it anywhere books are sold. Online, I like bookshop.org. It's really cool and it supports your local bookstore. But yeah, you just Google the title or my name and you will find it. And I can be reached. I have a website, as people do these days. So people can contact me through that. It's just my name. Yeah, I loved talking to you. It was really fun. And I would love to hang out in Tucson.
For sure. And I'll make sure I put those links in the show notes. And thank you so much for your time.
You too. This was super fun.
That was a really fun episode. And I really enjoyed talking to Lydia. I hope everyone goes out and gets a copy of her book. We loved it all. Depending on where you live, you might soon be experiencing beautiful music of the cicada. Cicada, 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 cicada. However you pronounce it, if you're living in areas where they're emerging, they will soon be your noisy neighbors. I thought this would be a great time to reboot my interview with Floyd Shockley. He's an entomologist at the National Museum of Natural History. How many cicadas can actually emerge this time? We're talking over a trillion. And that's because Different generations are emerging at the same time. So if you're not sure what that means, tune in to the pod next episode for an in-depth guide of everything you wanted to know about cicadas. Don't forget to head over to my website, www.jennifervertelin.com. Check us out on YouTube at Wild Connection TV, and go ahead and give me a follow on Instagram and Twitter at Real Dr. Jen. You can follow the podcast at Wild Connect Pod on Twitter. Thanks for listening.